Dearest Germantown friends, I return to this place with a full heart, with countless memories of a 5.5-year ministry which seemed longer than that, and with special remembrance of a number of you who were here at that time. If I started that list, I know I couldn't finish it, and so we'll just have to leave it in the realm of faith rather than of empiricism. I do want to thank my dear friend and cherished colleague, Kent, for providing with us this morning, or to us this morning, an order of service folder which exactly matches the color of my shirt. Now, Kent couldn't have known until just a few hours ago what color shirt I was going to wear this morning. So Kent will try this another round, and I could preach in a cellophane shirt or somehow intuit your intentions and see if we can agree another time. Good morning.
Good morning.
My career in ministry began at my birth. My maternal grandparents, Richard and Harriet Barton Boynton, were both ordained Unitarian ministers, but only Richard served as a parish minister in Boston, St. Paul, and Buffalo, New York, where I was born. The Unitarian ministry is in our family's bloodstream, one might say. In my early years, I attended church school and an occasional Sunday service. When I was a child, my mother gave me a nickel every Sunday morning before church to put in the collection plate. One Sunday after church, my mother found 38 cents in my pocket. David, where did you get this money? She asked. Oh, they passed a plate around with money in it, and I took my share. So you know that David, even as a 5 or 6-year-old, or maybe 3 or 4, was enterprising in certain areas of life beyond what was appropriate for a youngster. To continue the early life narrative, in 1944, when I was 15, I attended my first summer high school youth conference, or conferences, actually, there were two, one at Roe Camp in the Berkshires, where I'm sure many of you have attended, and at Ferry Beach on the Maine coast. And based on those 2 weeks away at a Unitarian summer camp, I bear witness that I was hooked. The Unitarian ministry has proved to be an excellent vocation. It combined pastoral ministry, preaching, program planning, public ministry on social issues, such as war and racism, and scholarship and writing. I never for a moment regretted my choice of a vocation. Like medicine, law, and teaching, the ministry is a lifelong profession. It is, as I've indicated in various other ways, a great pleasure to be with you today. And I do thank you most warmly for your welcome. Looking toward this engagement with you, I discovered anew in the book of Genesis, the first book of the Hebrew and Christian scriptures, a passage that captures the spirit of this occasion. Here it is, Genesis 8:22. As long as the earth endures, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease. The phrase, seed time and harvest, with all of its symbolic and affective connotations, caught my attention, because after 9 decades, my own life is cresting toward its inevitable end. For us, there is no seed time without harvest, as assuredly there is no harvest without seed time. The years of looking ahead shrink as the years of remembering lengthen. In due course, life comes to its inevitable end, and we as living, breathing, decision-making persons are no more. The theme of seed time and harvest provides a multidimensional image for our reflection, a beginning and an end. It invokes the grain and grass growing in fields and on hillsides the world over. It calls to mind the span of a single life, whether that of an animal or of a human person, seed time and harvest. It celebrates the universality of the rituals of both, of birth and growth and death, and the emergence to history of unique powers and symbols and art forms throughout the globe. Seed time and harvest also draws our attention to the institutions of family, church, and the political community, which embody and carry forward the values of the now 8 billion residents of the planet Earth. The first value-bearing institution I want to lift up is the family. That will not surprise you. My 90th birthday on September the 25th provided a rare occasion for my family to look backward and forward. Backward to the birth of my maternal grandmother, who died at the when I was 10 years old, so I knew her, and we were good friends. Backward to the birth of my maternal grandmother, Harriet Boynton, in the year 1859, two years before the Civil War began. And of John Brown's raid on the Federal Arsenal at Harper's Ferry. Those two events, historical events, occurred the year of Harriet's birth. And also forward, to look backward and forward, to the blossoming of someone whose name will be new to you, young Zachary Ross Eklar, my first great-grandchild, now 4 years old. For all of the ways in which families are fragmented by the explosive growth of television, the internet, and other 21st century technologies, there is, I grant, a gain in the astonishing accessibility of information in the modern world. You can get rid of all of your books and magazines because everything that was ever in print can be called up at the touch of a finger by the internet, on the internet, or World Wide Web. Now, I have to acknowledge that for 5 years, I have been offline. Yeah. So I don't have the prerogative of pushing that button and coming up with, you finish the sentence. I confess, and I suspect that some of you may be prepared to confess along with me, to have been nonplussed by the sight of my grandchildren interacting through their computers with a world of disembodied stimuli, images, and dramatic events, while barely acknowledging the presence of their mothers, fathers, siblings, and the great world out there. Have any of you ever had that feeling with your grandchildren? Many hands. Well, we have a club. However, on the other hand, the children seem to know what they are doing. Am I right? So I back off, welcoming every moment of direct homebound communication that modern life affords. I just take a step away and watch them do their thing, electronic thing, and just know that they and I occupy functionally different worlds. In the meantime, still in engagement with my grandchildren, I cherish every spontaneous glance or laugh or tear, every word or gesture that passes between my grandchildren and myself, as long as we acknowledge each other. There is hope that community and intimacy can survive and prevail in the 21st century. I have to admit that several of my grandchildren I hardly know, and their involvement in and almost obsession with the internet is a big part of that, of the reason for my being able to make that statement. And I wouldn't be surprised again if some of you found yourselves in that situation. A second value-bearing institution, in addition to the family, is the church. None of us knows exactly what is happening in the Jewish, Christian, Muslim monolith that claims the loyalty of a third of the world's population. For those of you who have not studied church history, Islam is a early, not so early, a heresy of the Christian, the Judeo-Christian faith. And Jesus is a middle-level prophet in Islamic teaching and iconography. The worldwide Muslim community is growing exponentially, while the Roman Catholic Church in the United States is losing members, whether because of priestly improprieties or the continuing and, to me, inexplicable refusal of the church to ordain women as priests. Are they really afraid that a woman pope would cause the collapse of St. Paul's Basilica? Excuse me, St. Peter's Basilica. I misspoke. Having spoken of the larger religious entities on the planet at the present day, I will mention the Unitarian Universalist religious community only in passing, and that's in great measure because it's the one I know best. My interactions with American Unitarian Universalism and its leaders, structures, ideas, and prospects have diminished since my retirement in the year 2005. I am involved in the Theodore Parker Unitarian Universalist Church in Boston, and I attended the 2018 UUA General Assembly in Kansas City, which this year marked the 50th anniversary of the AUA's Black Power controversy of 1967 to 72, in which, some of you may remember, I played a role. That's not intended to signify that in 1967 I was anything other than a white person. With women constituting almost two-thirds of the active Unitarian Universalist ministry today, a significant shift in attitudes, values, thresholds, and potential future institutional patterns and leadership is underway. None of us knows what particular changes, shifts, attitudinal transitions will occur in our UU community of faith, because in the past generation, the proportion of ministers has radically shifted from predominantly male to predominantly female. Someone one of you might be tempted to say, "Oh, there won't be any drama in that at all, Dave. It's just simply that the patterns of relationship within the denomination will shift by gender. Nothing else new will happen." I want to affirm that I think that that is a pipe dream, and that there will be changes. But I'm not smart enough to speculate in your pulpit today what those might look like. All I can say is, watch. A third value-bearing institution comes to mind, namely the political community. I will cut to the chase now and radically shift gears. I have been horrified, as many of you have, I'm sure, by the bad manners of the President of the United States, by his ignorance of history, and by his outrageous refusal to release his income tax returns. My question of the President is, what are you afraid of? I respect the office of the presidency, but I do not respect the incumbent. The power, here's a generalization. The power of the universe is displayed in deep conviction, in prophetic leadership, and in a social contract that secures a fuller and happier life, not for a few or for a favored minority, but for all. This is why the American people must rid themselves. We, the American people, must rid ourselves of a contemptuous and venal national leader. Mr. Trump's program of exclusion, collusion, and confusion is leading the American experiment to shipwreck and despair. The American experience calls each of us and all of us to a higher standard of righteousness. Mr. Trump sullies that standard by trivial values, coarse speech, and devious methods. Mr. Trump's problem is that he thinks being president is all about him. It has not occurred to him, it seems, that the presidency is an opportunity to lead the American people and the world community to new attainments of justice, human dignity, and freedom. Ideally, the president, whoever he is, gives voice to the people's own aspirations, yours and mine, be they citizens or refugees. To date, he has failed conspicuously in these tasks, and therefore invites upon himself the reproach of the American people and the verdict of history. In conclusion, my friends, let us remember that our worship together comforts and sustains us in every moment of the passage from seed time to harvest. We are the wheat. We are the growth. We are the consummation. We are richly blessed. Amen.
Amen.